On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Now, if you've been online pretty much any time really for the last 11 months, you will probably have seen some of the work put together by our next guest, who has been trying to track the prevalence of COVID-19 across the world throughout three different waves across an infinite number of health systems, but also in the last couple of months, the impact of vaccines and exactly how they are stopping the spread of COVID-19. So this early in the whole vaccination process, with some countries doing much better than others, what exactly can we learn about the impact of COVID-19 vaccines, and is there good cause to be optimistic? I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line again by John Byrne Murdoch, who is a senior data visualization journalist with the Financial Times. John, thanks for taking our call. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
You have been following the situation around the world, not only, of course, throughout these three waves, but also now since the mass onset of vaccinations in some parts of the world. Do I get the impression that there's a pretty positive picture to be painted?
Yeah, absolutely. So Israel, I think, as some of your listeners will know, has been really sort of at the front of the line on this. They started their mass vaccination program earliest and have rolled it out fastest. So the first good quality data we've had over the last month or so has been from there, where they're looking at the rates of cases and hospitalizations among the age group that has been vaccinated and the age groups, and all the signs there are looking pretty promising.
When you say all the signs, is there, I'm not looking to immediately start to nitpicking, but is there any negatives at all, or is it looking pretty healthy across the board?
It's looking pretty good. So the analysis they've done is very, very clever, because they wanted to make sure they were absolutely capturing the effect of the vaccine rather than any other sort of coincidences. So they split the data a number of different ways. They took the over 60s who've mainly been vaccinated and compared them to the under 60s. They looked at that pattern and found that cases and hospitalizations were falling much more steeply among the over 60s who've had those jabs. And they then also compared that to previous lockdowns to make sure that it wasn't just an effect of the winter lockdown over there. And they also looked at parts of the country that started vaccinating earliest versus latest. And all of those signs point to a good vaccine effect as measured by a steeper reduction in cases and hospitalizations among the older group than the younger group.
So broadly what they're seeing then is that as they vaccinate more and more older people, that the average age of those who require hospital admissions is coming down. Is that a fair summary?
Exactly, yeah. So that's another of the series I've been monitoring. And the one thing I'd say with that, though, is obviously the bulk of that trend is caused by fewer elderly vaccinated people getting hospitalised. Mm. But a small part of that is also the fact that younger people for some time in Israel had been getting hospitalised at higher rates, because the lockdown over there has been a lot less effective than the one here in the UK.
When you say a lot less effective, does that mean that people just haven't been adhering to it as much, or has it been defined on looser terms, or what's making Israeli youngsters more vulnerable than anyone else?
Sure. So it's mainly the former. I think, you know, due to there are certain communities in Israel where the guidance from those community leaders has not been necessarily to follow the lockdown in the way that we haven't had that issue in the UK. And I think this is actually an important part of the picture, because one of the reasons the vaccine effect is so apparent in Israel is that the comparison group, i.e. the unvaccinated people, have been continuing to get COVID at higher rates than they are in many other parts of the world. So if you look at a country like the UK, where cases and hospitalizations over here have also been coming down steeply among the elderly, among over 60s, over 70s, over 80, the reason it's harder to spot the vaccination effect in the UK is because of this strict lockdown we've now had for a couple of months. So I think that's one note of almost of optimism, I would say, really. When people look at the UK figures and say, well, where's our vaccine effect? I'd say, first of all, you know, we are now starting to see signs of it. But secondly, it would look a lot clearer if we were in a position like Israel, where cases were going up in younger people. Of course, we're glad they're not. But I think it's a reason that people shouldn't be sort of despondent that we're not seeing that effect yet in the UK.
Okay, so then the reason why people don't see that similar effect in the UK, it's not because the vaccine is less effective or that there's anything different to it, but it's the fact that Israel's stats are slightly skewed by simply how many younger people are ending up in hospital relative to the rest of the world.
Exactly that, yeah. Because if you imagine it as sort of, you've got two lines, and in the UK, both those lines are heading down steeply. It's young people who are in lockdown, it's older people who are in lockdown and vaccinated. In Israel, one line is heading down steeply, which is the elderly vaccinated, but the other line isn't heading down as steep because that lockdown has been less effective. So the gap between the lines in Israel is bigger, even though the rate of decrease in cases among older people is pretty much the same in the UK and Israel.
Okay, I think I've got you then. Then as regards the UK, because obviously it's not quite as far advanced along its vaccination programme, but it's still doing pretty well, then if you subtract that effect of the how the figures are skewed by the proportion of younger people in Israeli hospitals, does it look like the UK is following the same path, that there isn't something else that makes Israel an outlier, but simply that the more people that you give, particularly the Pfizer vaccine to, then the fewer and fewer people actually end up needing hospital treatment?
That's my reading of the data, yeah. So the trend among vaccinated groups in the UK and Israel is pretty much the same. If anything, there's actually a slightly steeper decline in cases among vaccinated people in the UK than Israel. So there's certainly nothing to suggest that the vaccine is being less effective in the UK than Israel. And again, you know, most of the early jabs in the UK whose effects we'd be seeing were Pfizer. We're obviously now seeing more AstraZeneca come in. But yeah, there's nothing in the data to suggest that the vaccine is not working in the UK as well as it is in Israel.
Okay, we should just apologise to listeners, by the way. There is a little bit of dropout on the line, but I think we can make out everything that John is saying. So we'll try to persevere for another few minutes if we can. Obviously, the fact that it seems to be easily just as effective in the UK is somewhat encouraging, because if there were still any lingering doubts about the B.1.1.7, the so-called UK variant or the Kent variant, it would seem that it doesn't make any difference as far as the vaccine is concerned, that it's still just as effective.
Yeah, I mean, there is one interesting point to look at there, which is that if you look at the UK data, to the extent that we can start seeing a vaccine effect in terms of the gap between vaccinated and unvaccinated, we're seeing that more in the figures from hospitalizations and deaths than we are in cases. And that, again, this is not at all certain, but it maybe hints at the fact that the vaccine is being more effective at preventing severe disease than at preventing just cases alone. And that is not inconsistent with data that we have seen from trials in South Africa, for example, where the impact on severe illness was seen to be stronger than that on simply getting infected at all. So again, it's not to say that that's definitely the case, but that would be an explanation that is consistent with what we're seeing. So even with these more infectious, more transmissible variants, the vaccines, including AstraZeneca, have been shown to still prevent or at least greatly minimise severe illness.
Okay. There is one other thing that's interesting, though, about the UK's approach, particularly when we compare it and our listeners will compare it to the experience they have here in Ireland, which is that the percentage of people, particularly in Northern Ireland, who've received their second jab is not really all that far different to the numbers received in the Republic. But what the UK is doing is that it's putting more jabs into more arms. So you might be waiting longer for your second one, but more and more people have got, you know, their first jab and therefore have some immunity, if you like, to it. Does that still seem to hold up? Because it would have seemed at the start like it was a bit of a gamble to space out the two jabs beyond what the regulators had suggested. But it seems maybe that it was the right decision on the UK's part.
That's right. Certainly what the data is looking like now. So we've had data for quite a long time now from AstraZeneca, which showed that vaccine is at its most effective with around a 12-week gap between doses. So that wasn't so much a gamble. That was really what the evidence said all along. With Pfizer and Moderna and others, the data has come out just in the last week or so showing that, again, the first dose on its own provides very, very high levels of protection, and that the second dose does boost those levels slightly. But we're talking about going from sort of around 85-90% to sort of 87-92%. So there's no need for anyone, I think, to be concerned that gap between the first and second dose is going to cause their levels of protection to come down.
So even just one dose, even though we've all been talking about it as being a two-dose program and with a couple of weeks in between each one, that the first dose would still reduce the prevalence of severe infection and, you know, someone that needs hospital treatment by somewhere between 85-90%.
That's for Pfizer and Moderna. That's the numbers we're looking at. For Oxford AstraZeneca, the efficacy was always slightly lower, but than those two vaccines, but still very, very high, especially for severe disease. But with all of those, we're seeing that the delay of the second dose for up to 3 months is not harming the level of protection that someone receives.
Okay. Just by the by, do you know of any other countries around the world that have taken that same approach where they've spaced out the two jabs longer than the regulators have expected, or is the UK flying solo on that?
To be honest, at the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't believe the UK is the only one. I believe there's a small number of countries who are doing that, and that is, I believe, also a growing number now that this evidence is emerging.
Okay, well, that's nonetheless, it's still very reassuring that if you're able to string them out, that you can potentially get a wider societal impact that way. Is there any other concern then around the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine when it comes to those new variants? Because I know that there are still, the jury seems to be out on some other parts of the world, not about how it impacts on the UK variant, but rather the new emerging South African or Brazilian variants, and whether there is a threat there.
So again, the data, you know, it's obviously true that we should be concerned about mutations and how they might impact the vaccines. But again, the data from South Africa in particular shows that it was essentially, the best way to think about it is there are two ways in which these vaccines work. One is they produce antibodies, which essentially prevent you from being infected really in the first place. The second is they produce B cells and T cells, which once you've been infected prevent you from becoming severely ill. And what the evidence shows in South Africa is that although the antibody response from AstraZeneca to the South African variant is less than it is with other variants, the T cell response, so that response that prevents severe illness, is still very robust. So The data for these mutations is showing that yes, things are a little bit more tricky, but in terms of the most important thing, which is preventing people getting really seriously ill, needing hospital or worse, that is very much still there with these new mutations, just as it is with the sort of standard variants, as it were.
And is that common across the three major vaccines that are in the market right now?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so it doesn't matter, irrespective of whether you're getting the Pfizer or the Moderna or AstraZeneca, that broadly speaking, that the T-cell response that is garnered by those vaccines still seems to be pretty much doing the job against the South African variant, at least.
That's right. So, you know, you can still understand people's concern is that, well, if we still let this thing circulate for too long, then we may hit upon a mutation which even affects the effectiveness of a vaccine for severe disease. But certainly at the moment, the vaccines are still working exactly as hoped in terms of preventing people getting really ill with this.
Okay, well, that, again, it's another reason to be slightly sunnier. There will be some listeners to this, John, who still think that the threat of COVID has been massively overplayed, and they think that it's basically just a rebranding of a typical winter flu. You've obviously been studying some of the data and the cycles around, you know, how much more prevalent COVID is than a winter flu. What have you found across the world?
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects of this, essentially. So one is just that the mortality rate of COVID is much higher, around 10 times higher than with flu. So someone who has COVID, they're in much more serious risk of serious illness and death than someone who has flu. The second is that just the sheer numbers we've seen, at least in the UK, of people needing hospitalisation, or indeed the numbers of excess deaths with COVID, are much, much, much higher than with flu. And to add a third thing, one of the other patterns we've seen this year is that flu itself, the numbers of people getting flu this year, this winter, have actually been much lower than usual, which is in part at least due to the fact that flu is, the R number, as it were, is lower for flu than COVID. So COVID spreads more easily than flu. Mm. So the sort of social distancing measures that people have been taking over the last few months, they've sort of, you know, they've helped us get the COVID numbers down, but they may also have completely flattened the flu. So especially if you look at a country like Australia or New Zealand, who've not really had much COVID, but have had social distancing in place, even they have essentially seen no flu at all. So it's not a case of flu just being rebadged as COVID, but the efforts that people have taken over the last few months have done a lot of work to suppressing flu this year.
And of course, the inhibitions on international travel as well means that if there was to be some part of the world that did have a reasonable flu outbreak, it's not as if there's many people flying to and from that part of the world to then bring it back to where they usually live.
Exactly that, yeah.
Is there a sense, John, just before I let you go, because you've been now dealing with this and you've been knees deep in all this kind of statistical comparisons for about 12 months now, is there a sense of almost just exhaustion on your part trying to keep on top of all this global data? Is it even possible for you trying to keep tabs of how it's all going worldwide to ever be able to switch off?
I mean, it's as you say, talking to me on a Sunday lunchtime, I think that's part of your answer. But there's, you know, the thing for me is that, you know, this is just endlessly interesting and it's so important and urgent that you know, the sort of number of hours I put into this sometimes makes me think I should take a break, but then I get sort of pulled back into it by wanting to see exactly what's going on. So yeah, you know, it's become increasingly difficult as the number of sort of facets to this the pandemic have grown. But yeah, I'm looking forward to a day for many reasons, of course, when this isn't dominating our lives so much. But for now, yeah, I'll keep plugging away.
Well, thank you very much for all of your plugging away and indeed for talking to us this Sunday lunchtime. And hopefully there will be some other Sunday lunchtimes not too far away when you're able to think about other things. In the meantime, very much appreciate your time this Sunday lunchtime. John Byrne Murdoch, Senior Data Visualization Journalist with the Financial Times.
Thanks very much.